your beautiful sparrows struggle to bear you swift above the dark earth, dense cloud of wings wilding against the heavens through mid-air to bring you down suddenly here, you, I swear, blessed one, smiling, a smile on your face never dying, asking, what do you suffer from now, and why summon me again? What want, what better thing in your craving heart do you wish to see? Who now, who must I coax back again to the agony you love? Who, Sappho, does you wrong?
American writer Dan Beachy Quick, reading from his English translation of the poet Sappho. In our conversation, we visit the idea of singing another's song. His translations from Greek poets of the lyrical and philosophical traditions are expressed with deep humanity and invite our 21st century sensibilities to participate in songs that have been meaningful for millennia. To paraphrase his words, these are poems which in their beauty use the eye to break apart the mind and remind us that we have a mouth to sing another's song. He is the author of several books of poetry, and his writing has been published in The New Republic, Poetry Magazine, Chicago Review, The Paris Review, and in anthologies including The Best American Poetry. He has taught writing at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and is currently professor of English at Colorado State University. Dan, from your anthology for Milkweed Editions, Stone Garland, you liken this book of translation of poets from the Greek lyric tradition to a walk in a country graveyard. I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but we imagine it overgrown with broken stones. Some are fragments, some are or resemble complete texts, but they're all in various levels of legibility. I quote here, "As such, you'll find poems here constructed from disparate fragments held together not by fact, but by resonance." Please tell us more about the power of resonance in the work and our experience of the poems.
Well, thank you for that question and such good memory of how that book wants to imagine itself as this place of memory and memorial and honoring and life once lived that in some miraculous way continues to live it in us, in ourselves still. It's an impressive recall of the introduction there. You know, the way that I think about that resonance really is in some ways twofold. For each one of the six poets translated in Stone Garland, there is this quality of consciousness, I think, that I'm hoping resonates from one fragment to a complete poem, from fragment to fragment, so that in some way the reader of these poems is able to recognize some quality of mind, quality of feeling, quality of heart, quality of language, if I've done my translation work appropriately, that gives any given reader the singular feeling of being in front of a singular mind. I've long had the feeling, somewhat taken from the great poet Alan Grossman, that one of the conditions of the poet is that the face forms around the voice, that the voice somehow precedes the face. And so one of the kind of great hopes I have here is that each one of these poets is indelibly enough articulated in the poems that I'm translating that one gets a sense of the visage. One feels, even if dimly and partially and in kind of deeply fragmented ways, that the face of another human being is staring back at them. At the same time, you know, I think the resonance operates in other kinds of ways, not from poem to poem, but from life to life. And, you know, one of the things that I love so dearly about working inside ancient literature as a contemporary lyric poet myself is the sense that so much of what makes any given human life our own are also experiences that have penetrated through, enriched, despaired other lives much like our own. And that one of the things that I feel so often overwhelmed by and in awe of is that aspects of our most intimate life also somehow intersect with our most anonymous life. And to feel that the poem is opening an experience that belongs to every human, will belong to every human, even as it's singularly felt on the pulse of any given one of us, is one of those resonances that moves me most. There's these kind of lovely forms of mimicry and imitation that riddle ancient poetry. Anacreon, who's a poet I dearly love, is countered by a poet some centuries later who just names himself Anacreon and writes in the style of Anacreon, so that all the poems that have passed down to our current age are known as the Anacreonata, that if we can't really cipher out the original voice from the voice imitating that original. We, of course, have the Homeridoi mimicking Homer, memorizing the Iliad and the Odyssey, going from city-state to city-state in this kind of beautiful repetition of an original poet myth maker. And, you know, I love that. I love in the Greek the verb rapto, from which we get a rhapsode, which technically means just someone who stitches various garments together. And one of like the inheritances that feels most resonant to me in being a living poet working within a very, very ancient tradition of lyric poets is the sense that my deepest work isn't seeking out a kind of originality of my own voice, but to resonate with the origin of any voice, to be a rhapsode myself, to understand that my deepest work is a work in common, is a work oddly of imitation, where what's original in my voice is just an accident of simply being the person it is. I can't help but be.
Oh, thank you for that. When we say fragments, we hear this word a lot in relation to ancient texts. That's a literal concept. These fragments that you work from may be text. They may have, in Sappho's case, they may have been on pottery. What are the sources that you work from?
Yeah, I'm primarily working just through the Greek as it's given in the Loeb Classical Library. Those are the ones that I had a professorship at Colorado State University where I work that allowed me to purchase the entirety of the Loeb Classical Library in Greek. So I have this authoritative text that allows me to go back to those poets and thinkers that I'm most interested in, and also has the English on the side. So when I get truly, truly bewildered, I have a little bit of a handhold to find my way back.
The Greek language is something I know very little about, other than its words have compound meanings. There are languages within the languages. Really love the way that you've described the work of a Greek word as not an individual worker bee, but each word being a hive of their own. Do I have that right? And might you speak to the powerful work of Greek words and also how you became acquainted with the Greek language?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, I love that you begin with the image of the bee and the hive, as it's one very dear to me and one very dear to the ancients who had, you know, as one of the ways that one can imagine what a divine mind looks like is to imagine it as the entirety of the hive, which is a many that acts as a one that acts as a many, and I feel that in, you know, the ways in which even down to the any given single letter or syllable in a word, how language might be operating in us, the particular mystifying buzz of what language might be. You know, to kind of get further into that question, there are things that I just have come to understand about language through the study of Greek that I simply wouldn't have come to without beginning this work a decade ago. And, you know, one of those is not only is Greek language compound in the way that you're suggesting, and so kind of resonant with possibilities, as if any given singular noun has a hidden hyphen promising that another word can adhere to it. There's some beautiful sense going back to the bees of a language that is primarily interested in the possibilities of accumulation rather than the processes of categorization, of singling out. But even, you know, more meaningful to me as a poet and a practitioner in poetry is that Greek isn't a syntactically based language. So to find a sentence, to work through a line, is also to kind of work through a maze, work through a kind of labyrinth, where English's kind of insistence on moving from subject to verb to object is a much more wondrously riddled equation inside what ancient Greek is, where any given line or any given sentence is constructed according to emphasis. So, you know, verbs will tend to hover at the end, though in moments of great urgency, you'll find the verb at the very beginning of the sentence. Subjects and direct objects are entwined with one another. And so you have to find your way by figuring out your case and matching your declensions and understanding the conjugations. And so there's this riddle that gives to me like this sense that I think poetry has also given me, though I never was quite able to articulate it so clearly until this 10 years of translation work I've been doing, which is that Greek is a language that has no interest in telling apart what it is to feel from what it is to think, what it is to think from what it is to feel. The heart is a kind of considerate organ, and the mind is a muscle that pulses in the Greek mind. And I love that kind of quality of it that encourages in my own poems a willingness to enter into the syntax as a kind of texture, a kind of surface, a nearly made sort of thing. And that word bears out in Greek. The word for poet simply means maker or doer. The verb that comes from poetes, the word for poet, is poeo, which you would translate as I do or I make. But Greek has a voice that English doesn't have, known as the middle voice. And the middle voice is when a verb performs itself against itself, kind of active and passive at once, a kind of Keatsian poetic is how I've thought about it. And some verbs change their meaning in the middle voice, and poeo is one of those. So that in the middle voice, poiesthai would mean not I do or I make, but I consider. One of the earliest notions we have of what poetry might be is that you can't have the thought the poem thinks until you make the poem, that you have to do this work of stitching word to word, image to image together, and only then do you have access to the thinking that the poem makes possible. And that kind of subtle rearrangement of the economy, that the poem isn't an idea I have, and so I write the poem, but the poem has the idea in it, and I have no access to that idea without the poem. That's one of the things that in ancient poetics can continue to teach us.
Wonderful. You know, there are many works I could cite to choose from in the companion volumes, and this is A Stone Garland and The Thinking Root, the two translations of Greek poetry. There are many that I could decide to choose from to represent the work as a whole, but selfishly, because I love this particular poem and the story behind it, let's consider one in the collection, Stone Garland, Mother and Child Cast Out to Sea by Simonides. And this is a lyric which I think greatly personalizes a moment of pure pathos, inspiring pity in the heart of the reader who has never met these characters unless they've maybe read the story. And as background, Danaea and her child Perseus are in great distress. Perseus is the progeny of Zeus, and they're sealed in a chest, alone together in a raging sea. There's a story behind that I might ask you to recount. What I was kind of moving to here is that this is a singular scene that moves the reader, even if you're unacquainted with the story. You describe the darkness of the night as a no-star shining night. And Danaea, uttering a prayer to her son to sleep through some very terrifying moments as soundly as he did in her womb. As we wander into this poem, can you tell me about the poet, who the poet was, and what you found to be some of the distinctive qualities of the voice of this poet?
Yeah, Simonides is kind of a famed character in the ancient Greek mind of poets, renowned for his wisdom, and he lived a very long life, especially for the time, well into his 90s. His poetry back then was noted for some of the qualities I hear you picking up on now, which is a real capacity to write poems that bring us to the condition of human pathos writ large. And I certainly agree and love Simonides for that. There's also, you know, certain kinds of skepticism. And in the ancient tradition, Simonides was the first poet to get paid for writing poems. He was at the beck and call of tyrants and wealthy merchants and the ancestrally rich, and so wrote poems at others' requests and got paid for that, and that was seen as a very dubious kind of activity. There's a very famous story about him where a kind of obnoxious rich man named Scopas invited him to write an ode celebrating a kind of honor or victory. And so Simonides wrote a poem about the heroes Castor and Pollux and went to Scopas's mansion and read the poem that didn't mention Scopas by name. And Scopas was terribly offended. He paid money for this poet to write a poem to honor him, and took it as a grave insult, and he kind of put Simonides at the end of the table so he could barely get any food. And then some servants of the house come and tell Simonides that there was two young men at the door who had an urgent need to speak to him. And so the poet got up and went out through the house to the door and looked into looked out into the streets, and no one was there. And at that exact moment, the entire roof collapsed and killed everyone that was inside at that feast. And they were mangled so terribly that the only way the grieving families could kind of mourn the proper body was that Simonides had memorized where every single person had been sitting. And so he's also sort of credited as the first one to come up with systems of mnemonics, that we, you know, have ways of going about the work of memory because of this poet. There's a little anecdote about him I find so moving that really tells me where the tyrant of Syracuse, Hero, asked him what the nature of the god is one day, and Simonides was silent and was asked again for day after day, and Simonides never gave an answer, and it upset the tyrant, who wanted an answer about such an important question, and Simonides simply said that the longer he thinks about it, the less he understands. And I think, like, the ongoing human importance of Simonides as a poet is, I think he is of what it is to have a human life in relation to force that is larger than the one you have yourself, and when that can be whatever kind of force it is that the gods are, it can be whatever kind of force it is that a wealthy person holds over you who are in that person's employment. It can be a sense of the force of the world itself coming towards you in a way where you simply don't know how to avoid the trouble it's heaving your way. And what makes Simonides so great is he gives us people who are weathering the difficulty of the suffering it is that they're in, not to triumph over it, but to understand that that's our human position.
Yeah, the pain and challenge is a part of a universal experience among humans. And it's deeply felt in this poem that I'm going to ask you to read for our listeners.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Mother and child cast out to sea for cedar, mark, and silver. When in the coffin intricately carved, the wind made the wood tremble, and the horrid sea crashed down with wet cheeks, wetter yet. Around Perseus she threw her loving arms and said, "Child, what suffering I hold." But you sleep, Your suckling heart slumbers on somber planks, bronze bolted in this no star shining night. You drop down in the deep morning veil, dark of the sea sprays thick mist above your hair as by a wave covered. You are careless, careless of the wind's keen howl, lying within my purple shawl, your lovely face. If this terror was terror for you, you'd turn your small ears to my hushed words. I tell you, sleep as still in my womb, baby. Go to sleep, sea. Go to sleep, my depthless trouble. Out from your mind, let some change appear, Father Zeus. For what in my prayer is too bold or not just, look aside, forgive me.
Brilliant. The two volumes in the Seed Bank series are distinguished by subtitles describing poets from the lyric tradition and poets of the earliest Greek philosophy. And I'm struck by the latter, the notion that early thinking about the world is expressed in the poetic form. There's a tendency in our contemporary culture to think about philosophical and scientific inquiry in terms of technical prose. Would you speak about how you parsed the poetry into these two volumes from these two distinct traditions?
Yeah, this is one of the great gifts doing this work of translation from the ancient Greek has given me, is a much more capacious sense of the many ways in which disparate, discrete fields for us are in the ancient mind, a strange interwoven one. You know, what I love so deeply about pre-Socratic philosophy is that there's no proper division between natural science, biology, philosophy, poetry, theology, astrology, all of it, mathematics, all of it's a kind of one. And one kind of remembers, you know, ancient tales that the muses, they come down Mount Parnassus every day holding hands and singing together. And one of the things that feels so such a paucity in contemporary life is the ease with which we think things like physics and poetry and philosophy are their own separate disciplines. And to have a kind of tradition where we can go back to thinkers who somehow were in, you know, of the opinion that every single one of us who is here in the world has a kind of responsibility to explain for ourselves what the world is and how we came to be in it, is one of the places where I think a kind of radical sense of lyric condition assumes the same thing, that one is in one's life in such a way that you have to find a way not only to explain everything that's in it, but much more beautifully, that you have to learn to sing everything that's in it. And I feel that is such a wondrous charge and wondrous challenge. And it will sound very tangential, but it might be the best way to give a kind of facticity to what it is I'm trying to say. You know, many of the first philosophers, Empedocles and Parmenides and Xenophanes, primary among them, were writing their philosophy in the same hexameters that Homer wrote his epics in. And, you know, to go back to that kind of hive of words and the image that of a hive isn't just visual, but it's also sonic. It's this buzz that sounds singular and collective, alone and multifarious all at the same time. And there's words inside ancient Greek that I've become, you know, really obsessed by, that in their sonic life seem to suggest one another, merge into one another, and then kind of wing their way out. And some of these, you know, Socrates, you know, thinks about, where Socrates is writing in his way, in his way, you know, along these kind of fanciful etymologies where he's talking about Heros for hero and Eros for love as being cognate, of being emerged from the same kind of principle, hero and love. And then, you know, just kind of, you know, as I sometimes oddly do to pass the time, kind of just looking through the Scott and Liddell dictionary, there's another eros that we would spell E-R-R-O-S that means limping. It's like hero and love and limping somehow all triangulate in my mind. They resonate or they buzz together with a kind of mutual implication. And it made me think about how many of the heroes in ancient Greek indeed are limping. Oedipus's name means lame-footed. Achilles is killed by an arrow that goes to his heel. Philoctetes is bitten by a snake on the ankle and abandoned by Odysseus because the wound is so mortifying to everyone around him. And this idea of the hero with a wounded foot, like, is very meaningful to me. And then to realize that the meter of heroes is hexameter, this 12-foot line, and the meter of love in ancient Greek are hendecasyllabics that we get from Sappho, an 11-foot line, which is to say, like, the very metrics of love has a wounded foot. It limps. It doesn't get to the rigid marching of the 12 syllables. It limps only to the 11th and starts anew. And when one begins to feel like these ideas are like embedded in the near vascularity of the verse itself, I just find it breathtaking.
Yeah, it is amazing. I think of Oedipus gaining his known name as he of the swollen foot.
Yeah, it's very, and just to know that for the hero to be able to love, the hero must be wounded. And to understand, you know, that these poets are trying to usher us in, not to our human strength, but to our human fragility. That's been an ongoing lesson for me.
I think this idea, too, of the hard sciences and the practice of the liberal arts, if you will, are converging again in a lot of contemporary poetry. This is the basis for what we sometimes call eco-poetics. You know, they've been around for a while. Arguably, Robinson Jeffers and others really kind of exercise this connection with scientific principles. It's nice to see it pursued in this particular way in contemporary poetry.
Yeah, I agree completely.
You mentioned Sappho, and just last year, Tupelo Press published your translations of the surviving fragments of Sapphic poetry, or Sappho's poetry, entitled Wind Mountain Oak. And while we could probably spend several hours discussing the beloved poet's work and how it's been rendered in just the translations from the 20th and this first quarter of the 21st century. There were translations in the 50s, Richard Lattimore and Mary Banard. And then it seems a long gap until she's really considered again. And the great poet Ann Carson and yourself most recently rendered works of Sappho. But I'd like to settle into the pulse in the meter of her work, which we kind of just discussed, but especially as you've described it in commentary in this particular book, the meter that begins with the fever of heavy stress, then transitions through the middle of the line to a calmer order at the end. And this seems to describe love poetry in particular. Can you tell me about this pulse that you discovered in her work and have endeavored to present in the translations?
I think it's helpful, you know, to understand something of like the Greek notion or Greek sense of what metrics are. Their sense of the metrics of the dithyramb, which were sacred to Dionysus. These are metrics that should you be around a great poet chanting out those dithyrambs. The metrics alone are the thing that intoxicate you with the god's own power, that they understood that the rhythms of a poem act upon the body in a way that is, in some sense, more profound than the language that makes those meters available, as if the deepest part of the poem hasn't anything in the end really to do with language, other than we can't access the rhythm inside the language in anything other than words. It lets us feel a set of stresses that alters the self in relation to the moment the self finds themselves in. And I think we've really lost a sense of that. Our ears are so much less intelligent than they could be. So with Sappho's hendecasyllabics, just as you were pointing out, the nature of a sapphic is to begin very much with very heavy stresses on what we would mark often as kind of spondees. And the quality of that musically is like an extraordinarily pointed slowness, where you have stress after stress after stress. And around the middle of the line in a sapphic, that begins to regulate back to what we would call iambic, which is that unstressed stress, unstressed stress, that thadum, 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 that is the heart returning to a much more regular kind of meter. So that one of the ways that we can kind of bodily interpret what a sapphic poem should feel like is that every line like has the startle of an almost initiatory encounter with something in the world, the shock, the startle of something being absolutely real and present in front of you, that starts the adrenal, that starts the heart pumping, as if fight or flight is like the only proper response, because you're so startled by the fact that something other than you is real. And then the heart begins to adjust to that surprise, only to come to the next line and be shocked into the next recognition. And that rhythm feels to me like a kind of deeply human one, where at every turn, the world surprises us that it is so undeniably and obviously shining forth as world. You know, our bodies recover, grow accustomed. And what's so beautiful about Sappho, in part, is she never lulls us back into the ease we come with understanding what we think we know about the world. She shocks us back into a first connection over and over and over again.
I hazard to ask for a poet's favorites who has studied the work as you have of a singular voice. Is there a fragment you might read which gives us a visceral connection to this experience that we're talking about?
Yes, I'll try and hope it does. The poems where I tried to really trace the quality of the hendecasyllabics were in the very few poems that have survived the millennia whole, so that those felt like the ones where I could really hold myself as much as I'm capable to that rhythm, to that metric. So here's a very, very famous poem. Deep-throned, dark-carved wood, deathless Aphrodite, while weaving child of Zeus, I beg, I pray to you, don't hurt me, my thought. Let grief never seduce, queen, my shard-scared heart, but come here. If at some time ever you heard my fool's voice pour out its wine to wet the ground, then hear me again. And leave your father's home free from its gold confines, love's chariot yoked. Your beautiful sparrows struggle to bear you swift above the dark earth, dense cloud of wings wilding against the heavens through mid-air to bring you down suddenly here, you, I swear, blessed one, smiling, a smile on your face never dying, asking, what do you suffer from now, and why summon me again? What want, what better thing in your craving heart do you wish to see? Who now, who must I coax back again to the agony you love? Who, Sappho, does you wrong? And if now she runs away, soon she will chase. If she refuses gifts, soon she'll bring her own. If she won't love you, soon she will be longing, even if she doesn't want to. Come to me now again. Save my mind scathing in thought. when the war-loud din of my heart's endless desire ended. Now grieves, not grief, you be my battle-mate.
Amazing, the image of this being a battle. It's what we're left with at the very end of this deeply passionate poem.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poem, and such a, you know, especially given our conversation just now, to see Sappho figure out how to ask Aphrodite to be her battle mate and put this armor on to go to battle in the wounded hendecasyllabics of one of her greatest love poems. I find it very moving too.
You are a poet and a teacher, as well as a translator. There is a passage in Of Silence and Song, and this particular passage, I think, dwells in the intersection of all of these roles, poet, teacher, translator. We could probably add human to that, while also invoking a principal problem for a student. The principal problem, I would say, in poetics is, what is it to seek beauty? The student asked this directly in this passage on page 39. What is it to seek beauty? Might you read that in closing?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, and should say that I've been working on helping Colorado State create a new core curriculum that holds the arts and the humanities and the STEM fields in a properly complicated embrace. And so I've been, for the first time in my life, really teaching first-year students and teaching them a class on truth and beauty with Keats as the primary text. And this is literally a question that a student asked in that first rendition of that class. A student asks, what is it to seek beauty? What is it to try and live a life that's good? That's a question, is my answer. The class is silent. I think I have a point to make. Why does the flower seek the sun? It wants to eat the thing that gives it life. The daisies think they can swallow the star, but then a bee lands in their sunlit open mouths, and the field lives and honey fills the hive. We're studying John Keats. I thought I had a point to make. But now I see I don't know exactly what a point is, what it is to have a point. A point has no part. Some purpose belongs to nothingness. Beauty is just one thing among many that obliterate consideration. One might even say consideration also obliterates itself.
Once again, a full revolution to the bee and the hive, the thing and the collective.
One of the gifts here that it's freed me as a poet from the fear of being trite to understand that certain images bear out their meaning through millennia, and rather than avoid writing about flowers, we should understand that there's a human lifelong encouragement to participate in places of meaning that have been meaningful for countless others before us.
Dan Beachy Quick, whose latest volume of translated poetry, Wind, Mountain, Oak, is available from Tupelo Press. Dan, thank you so much for making this time on a summer day.
Thank you so much, Vincent. It's a real pleasure.
Dan Beachy Quick's recent translation from the surviving fragments of the work of Sappho, Wind, Mountain, Oak, The Poems of Sappho, is available from Tupelo Press. The Asymptote Journal is the premier destination for world literature in translation. Find the current issue and archives at asymptotejournal.com. And while you're there, please consider subscribing to the mailing list for fortnightly emails and links to the frequently updated reviews and essays in the Asymptote blog. I'm Vincent Hostack for the Asymptote Podcast. Till next time.